There's a warning that is important in the book Song of Solomon, which we are studying, are now in our third study of this book. It's a warning that's repeated three times, and it is addressed to the daughters of Jerusalem, probably young women without adult life experience. The bride or the woman in this story gives a warning to these young people. And it's debated, of course, like everything else in this book, as to what exactly it means. But I'm convinced that her warning means this: don't awaken love prematurely. In verse 7 of chapter 2, where we ended last week, that verse is found. And so therefore, it's the jumping off place today. It's the sort of the beginning of our section today, where we ended last week. And then in verse 5 of chapter 3, where we are going to end today, the same exact warning is given, the same word of caution. Don't awaken love prematurely. Don't fan the flames of sexual desire and infatuation until they can serve the purpose God intended for them. The warning's repeated because it's important. Listen to this passage from one of Eugene Peterson's books. The consultation had been arranged on the telephone so that when she walked into my study, it was a first meeting. Her opening statement was, "Well, I guess you want to know all about my sex life. That's what they always want to know." I answered, "If that's what you want to talk about, I'll listen. But what I would really be interested in finding out, though, is your prayer life." She didn't think I was serious, but I was. I was interested in the details of her prayer life for the same reason that her psychiatrist had been interested in the details of her sex life, to find out how she handled intimate relationships. I had to settle for the details of her sex life at that time. Sex was the only language she knew for describing relationships of intimacy. At a later time, when she came to understand herself in relation to a personal God, she also learned to use the language of prayer. This woman illustrates one of the reasons to heed the warning about too much too soon. Sex was her only language for intimacy. This woman knew the rudimentary speech of her body, but did not know the language of her heart. And so the repeated warning in Song of Solomon, the word of a woman at some stage later in her life, turning to young people and saying, don't arouse these feelings, these desires, until it's the right time. Well, we're going to continue now in verse 8. You might want to turn there of chapter 2. And I think the reason I'm sort of talking about the context of this cautionary phrasing is that it begins and ends the section we're looking at today, as I already mentioned. And I think it's best to read what we're going to read now, basically two different texts, two different stories, is to read them having in mind that an older person is talking to younger people. It could be like a youth camp. And so, like, we'll take away the junior hires and high schoolers away, and we'll bring in some thoughtful adults, and they'll give a sex talk. You know, it's spring, and the young men's fancies lightly turn to thoughts of love and all that sort of thing. And it's sort of that idea is, with younger people in mind, some stories are told, some memories are made, some instruction is given, and so on. And I think that's the context for this. And let me read now the beginning in verse 8 and then talk a bit more about it. The woman speaking, the bride speaking. "Listen, my lover, look, here he comes, leaping across the mountains, bounding over the hills. My lover is like a gazelle or a young stag. Look, there he stands behind our wall, gazing through the windows, peering through the lattice. My lover spoke to me and said, arise, my darling, my beautiful one, and come with me. See, the winter has passed. The rains are over and gone. Flowers appear on the earth. The season of singing has come. The cooing of the doves is heard in our land. The fig tree forms its early fruit. The blossoming vines spread their fragrance. Arise, come, my darling, my beautiful one. Come with me." Now, if it's true that this woman, and I take also as the case that the man, her, the one she calls the lover here, or my man, is in the room with her. And if it's also true that they are giving some instruction to younger people, I think what she's doing is this. That you can't just lecture folks about what they ought to do if you don't show any understanding of their circumstances. It doesn't do any good to say to people who are growing up and sort of on the verge of gaining some sexual maturity, on the verge of adolescence, and say, well, don't smoke, don't chew, don't go with girls who do. You know, that's my advice, and stay away from trouble, and don't do this, and don't go there. And if that's all we say, we've done very little good, if any at all. What this storyteller is doing, this woman is doing, is going back, I think, to an occasion early in her life when she began to discover the power of romance. It's a story that's cast in the past. It's not in the present, at least verses 8 through 13. We know that because she quotes the man. He doesn't speak in his own voice. It is she quoting what she remembers of this occasion when he came looking for her when they were both young, is how I read it. I think that's what's taking place here. And she's saying, I know what it's like to be young. I remember the first time this guy came for me. I remember what I felt. I remember what he was like. And let me recall that for you so that I can speak into your life about what's going to happen next for you. This is a couple now. If photography had been invented, you can sort of picture them taking out a picture of themselves as young people and sort of showing the folks in front of them what we used to be like when we were kids, kind of thing. The young man is filled with energy, as young men are often at this stage of life, just on the verge of kind of adolescence, puberty, awareness of girls. It's, of course, completely difficult to imagine, and I'm trying to speak in our culture or some culture familiar to us, and this is a 3,000-year-old Middle Eastern culture. So we're obviously... We're not saying what actually happened to these people. We can't even imagine it. We don't have the cultural familiarity to even know what it was like. But I do think it's telling a story that travels well, even to the 21st century. We can tell this story in our setting, and that's what I'm suggesting we do. And I picture this guy as someone who grew up in kind of an ordinary place, and you know, your earliest experiences with your parents, and your family at home, and your brothers and sisters, and maybe your the kids in the neighborhood, and you sort of have a category for people. And later, you maybe towards junior high age or so, you start developing buddies who are your own age, and guys you play ball with, and do things with, and talk about life, and get in trouble with, and start sort of having relationships with other guys. And then all of a sudden, someday, the day occurs when you realize, you know, I don't want to be with my parents, don't want to be with my family, don't want to be with my buddies. Today, what I would like to do is spend some time with that girl who I can't stop thinking about. And it's sort of a new thing. And so here comes our friend, bounding like a gazelle, leaping, cartwheels, you know. I'm going to find her. And he's sort of filled with enthusiasm and a sense of confidence and sort of knows everything at that age. And then he realizes he gets up to her house and he doesn't know what to do. So he's also, you know, crashes into insecurity. So this confidence, you know, followed by insecurity, standing outside the wall, what do I do now? Looking in the lattice, peering, hoping somebody will notice them, and what do I say? And, you know, it just sounds to me like young people. I think the bride is recalling the day when he came looking for her in this way for the first time. He says the same sentence twice, arise, come, my darling, and so on. It begins and ends his speech, which again suggests the unit ends, I think, with the second giving of that sentence. I hope his voice didn't crack. It's not clear that, you know, he's completely used to using an adult's voice yet. It's sort of a borderline deal for him, but he's trying to give this speech. The winter's over. The flowers are beautiful. And for the first time, I've noticed girls are now beautiful. I'm connecting all these dots. And she's looking out, and she's as fascinated as he is. Look, you know, she remembers it. She can describe it. The man, she calls her lover, as he is now in the telling of the story, was not, of course, then. But he's coming. I remember what he was like, and I remember the day. I was put in mind warnings and outdoor dates and that sort of thing. I was put in mind of a time when Les and I were young, not quite this young, but I asked her to go with me on a picnic. We went out to the coast, and it was a beautiful day, and the waves were crashing, and the birds were singing and all. And we spread out this picnic on a grassy area, and she sat on one side, and I sat kind of up against some bushes on the other, and we had this lovely picnic and looked into each other's eyes and on and on. And I got home, and I the next day had the worst case of poison oak in the history of poison oak. I thought I would die from poison oak. And I'd been leaning up against these bushes, which I didn't recognize, and it was terrible. But anyway, the occasion that caused the poison oak was terrific. The warning is don't take picnics in patches of poison oak. There's something winsome about this. There's something beautiful about it. And then I think the story, we move to verse 14. Still imagining a couple speaking on the youth retreat to young people, but now they're speaking in real time. And the guy speaks up for the first time. She is not quoting him anymore. He's speaking in his own voice, verse 14. My dove, in the clefts of the rock, in the hiding places on the mountainside, show me your face. Let me hear your voice, for your voice is sweet and your face is lovely. Then they speak together. This is very difficult to translate and interpret, but we'll take a swing at it. I think they both now are speaking together. Catch for us the foxes, the little foxes that ruin the vineyards, for our vineyards that are in bloom. And then the bride speaks, the woman speaks. My lover is mine, and I am his. He browses among the lilies until the day breaks and the shadows flee. Turn, my lover, and be like a gazelle, or like a young stag on the rugged hills. So, in trying to be helpful, this couple, the woman particularly, tells a story of what it was like when they were young. They're trying to help young people. And then they start to say what it's like now. And the guy says to his wife, in the presence of these folks, you're as beautiful to me now as you were the day I first fell in love with you, the day I first saw you, the day I was first captivated by you. I would love to spend a day again with you in the hills, away from everything, just you and me. Your face, your form, your voice, everything about you is as captivating to me now as it ever was. And he's making a point about a relationship that begins and develops, growing more beautiful rather than less. Not a relationship that peters out after a period of time and I'm bored now and I'm about to move on to someone else. He's talking about a relationship that is growing. And you are as captivating to me as you ever were, I think, is what he's saying. We'll skip verse 15 for a second, and then the woman speaks. My beloved is mine, and I am his. My lover is mine, and I am his. And she's telling young folks about the security of knowing that their relationship is not going to end. It's not going to change. We belong together. Everything we experience grows out of the certainty of our connectedness, that we've been joined together. It's not going to go away, that we are his. I am his and he is mine. And then the next thing she says is also difficult. You're going to get tired of me saying this. Difficult to interpret. But I think it's roughly a sexual, she's winking and talking in kind of guarded language about their physical relationship. He browses among the lilies until the day breaks and the shadows flee, turn, my lover, and be like a gazelle or a young stag on the rugged hills. The separated hills is another way to translate that, probably. And it may refer to her breasts, that there's a long history of interpreting this phrase that way. And it's sort of like she's saying with a kind of a laugh in her voice and wink in her eye, you know the gazelle thing you did before? Well, I've got plans for you, big fellow. We're going to do that gazelle thing again, but in a entirely different context. And she's saying it with that sort of sense, again, so the young people can hear that all this stuff that starts with enthusiasm and no direction leads someplace great. I'm his, he is mine, we're together, we will be together, he sees her as one whom he would choose over and over again, and so on. So anyway, they're telling this story, and it starts with a warning that you don't want to make choices that will connect you to the wrong person. You want to allow all the stuff that's true of you to lead you into a relationship with the right person. That's what it's there for. It's to focus your attention and move you toward the person that God wants you to be with. Let me take the last section that we're going to consider, which, again, finally in verse 5, come to the warning repeated, don't stir up love until it's time. Verse 1 of chapter 3. All night long on my bed, I looked for the one my heart loves. Oh, by the way, I forgot something. Excuse me. Probably going to mess up the slide, people. The verse 15, we skipped over. It says, catch the foxes for us, the little foxes, and so on. It's still the occasion where these two are talking about, kind of, now they're married, and they're talking about their marriage, and they're appreciating each other. But there's also the wisdom in the midst of this of saying that they make choices to deal with problems, little problems, before they become big problems. They want their young people to hear that too, that it's not all just terrific, and everything doesn't work out the way it should all the time. It's not just one good experience followed by another. There are plenty of times when we have arguments and disagreements and misunderstanding, where things aren't right between us, when we have to solve problems, and we want to deal with them before they get large and ruin everything, before they overcome us, before there are too many. And so they are in sort of telling their story, also tell the story of having to deal with problems before they become too large. Now we'll move on to verse 1 of chapter 3. All night long on my bed, I looked for the one my heart loves. I think this is a dream scene. There's another one later when the bride also, I think, tells a dream sequence. She's on her bed at night, sort of half awake, half asleep. All night long, she has this dream recur, and she kind of gets over and kind of comes back, and it's a hard dream. It's a nightmare of a dream, as a matter of fact. And she's telling the young folks about this, too. Let me tell you what I learned from my dream. All night long on my bed, I look for the one my heart loves. I look for him, but did not find him. I will get up now and go about the city through its streets and its squares. I will search for the one my heart loves. So I looked for him, but did not find him. The watchmen found me as they made their rounds in the city. Have you seen the one my heart loves? So all of a sudden, she has this dramatic sense of loss. The one who has meant everything to me is now gone. I don't know where to find him. I don't know how to get anyone to help me find him, and so on. Now, he's not really gone. She's having this dream. But the dream is terrible precisely because if you love someone very much, if you've worked hard to build a life together, if you've trusted one another and learned and grown and become and are becoming what God intends for you, to lose a person like that is gut-wrenching and heartbreaking. And she's also going to say, don't follow someone who won't stick around. I think that's the point of this message. Don't choose someone that you could wake up one day and find they've gone, they've left, where their ability to commit and be loyal and stay true to a marriage doesn't exist. So, have you seen the one my heart loves? Scarcely had I pressed them when I found the one my heart loves. Things were restored in her dream. I held him and would not let him go until I brought him to my mother's house, the room with the one who conceived me. And here's the warning again. Daughters of Jerusalem, I charge you by the gazelles and does of the field, do not arouse or awaken love until it so desires. It's so important. Don't choose a guy who will leave. Don't choose a person who will be there for a short time, followed by another, followed by another. Don't kind of let the waves of passion and infatuation and all those things take you to a place where when you come to your senses, you realize you shouldn't be there. You're given all this stuff for a good reason, to make a good relationship. And so we come to the end, I think, of this youth retreat. And the young people have heard, and hopefully they've benefited from it. And so the question then is, what do we make of this? And there's... it may be that we'll be on the youth retreat someday. Maybe that we'll be talking to young people. Maybe our own children or the children of someone else or the children of this church. It may be that we can speak to young people about these things. But the vast majority of us here are no longer in the condition of don't start something until it's time, till the right time. we have long passed the borderline of adolescence. We have already started making all those choices. And the majority of people I know, when they look back, would like to do it over again. Would like to change something, either stuff that was done to them that they had no ability to make different, or choices they made they wish they hadn't made, or people they hurt or have been hurt by. And so you kind of read this and say, don't start this thing prematurely and say, okay, that's great, yeah, thanks a lot, but we're past that now. Is there a word in here for me? Is there another good word that might come out of this? I want to read you something, or refer to something, quote it briefly, but refer to an article in the Wall Street Journal. It was sent to me, it was an online journal from April 4th, Wall Street Journal, and it was a story an article by a woman named Donna Freitas, who teaches at Boston University, and it says in the article, she did a survey of over 2,500 students. And comments in the article about her studies about the widespread experience of sex as nothing more than pleasurable recreation. Non-religious private and public colleges and universities were surveyed, and she says, quote, not a single person at these schools, 2,500, not a single person at these schools said of that their peers valued saving sex for marriage. And only 7% said that they felt their friends wanted to reserve sex for committed, loving relationships. She teaches a class at Boston University, I said, and the majority of the class is sort of making the feminist argument against anonymous sex. She's talking to students, trying to help them think of themselves as, you know, kind of from the basis of feminist theory as being worth too much for that sort of behavior. But in addition to making that argument, she's given books by evangelical authors, and in the article mentions a woman named Lauren Winner, who wrote a book called Real Sex, which is captivating, I'll read the quote, to her students. Now, I want to stop here for a minute and say that Lauren Winner is going to be here giving a lecture on May 4th. Her book is excellent. I commend it to you, the book Real Sex. Very interesting lady, a terrific writer, very insightful person. And, you know, bring your friends. She's going to be here lecturing on May 4th. But here's what Freitas said about these books by people who read the Bible and read by her class. My class seems shocked that somewhere in America there are entire communities of people their age who really do, quote, save themselves, unquote, for marriage, who engage in old-fashioned dating with flowers and dinner and maybe a goodnight kiss. They reacted as if these authors describe a wonderful fantasy land. The salient point, that fantasy land, close quote, the salient point is not that college students are drawn to sex, but the disconnection between one's physical, the disconnection of one's physical experience from everything else is what is striking to her, and certainly was striking to me. So what is this, the passage we just read in the Song of Songs, which warns people don't start stuff that you shouldn't start, what does it have to say to people who have crossed that line now and whose marriage is harder than they wish it was, and where there's disagreement there and they don't know how to make it better and where to turn next, or were married once and as far as they knew they were doing the right thing and did their best and tried to choose the right partner and that fell apart and they don't know why, or they were hurt by how they were treated by adults when they were kids and not ever given a chance to get it right to begin with, and what do they do? Or people who have made bad choices and they know they made bad choices and they regret every minute of them but can't undo them again. And what about people who are single and wish they weren't? People who start relationships and break them for the same reasons, get in the same mess over and over again. And it's one thing to say don't start until it's time, but what message do we have for other folks? Well, I think the story of our bride and groom at the youth retreat is good in its own right. The advice for that setting, if that setting were to be reproduced, is good advice. The approach they took. Be vulnerable, tell your story, acknowledge, and invite people into a good story. But what's even more important, I think, is their willingness to step into the life of someone else and try to be helpful. The willingness to speak a word of hope to those who are young. And it is that it is not what they said as much as that they said something to other people to try and recognize that there's broken and hurt folks around. And can I help you? I know the story. I know what God has said is true and good. Can I help you hear that and hear it in a way that applies to your life so that you can take a step forward? It's the willingness to connect to one another and not leave folks alone, isolated, fighting on their own. It's a community in which relationships occur and thrive so that we have the benefit of other people's voice. This is one of the great points Winter makes in her book, frankly. One of the things I appreciate most about the book, that we're in this together. Parents are never going to be able to get precisely on the wavelength of their kids so that they are the coolest person talking to the kid. Not going to happen. Whatever the recent exhibitionist celebrity, life on Facebook, you know, YouTube, whatever is happening, whatever stupid fashion is being promoted for 10-year-olds or whatever, I can't possibly stay cool enough to be alert and ready and to know exactly what to say as a parent in the lives of young people. But what we can say for everybody is we know the big story. We know what we were made for. We know the faithfulness of God. We know the great things that are true, and we can tell them from our own experience, and we can offer them to other people. We can point them to a place. We can offer to help. And that's what this couple does for the folks in their world, and that's what we can do for each other. That's why I love the quote from Eugene Peterson that we started with. He's talking to a woman that assumes all anybody ever talks about is sex, and that's the only possible language for intimacy. And he said, okay, I'll listen. But I got something else to tell you about. I can tell you about another language, a language of hearing and knowing God. I can teach you the language of prayer. If what we need to do is talk about whatever you're into for right now, we'll do that. There's no rejection, no go away. But I have something else to offer you. That's the nature of his ministry. And I think it is that sense that Craig and Chris Duncan's life can stabilize ours and open up hope. And when our son got married, when Jeff and Carrie got married, they had a deal. I can't remember if I told the story before. I probably have. At the rehearsal dinner, where we sort of a marriage game, and you talked about how you met the person you're with, and you were, you know, and my parents were one of the couples. Stop me if I've done this. I probably have, but and they won. You know, it's like, can you go take the half people out and you answer the question? They come back in and. You know, can you get right the story of how you initially met one another, first were captured by one another, whatever, captivated by one another? And so my parents tell the story being about a chemistry class as sophomores in high school, and my dad borrowed a pencil from my mom, and that was it. And borrowing pencil, and they both remembered it, you know, and they've been married 63 years. But I talked to a whole bunch of people afterwards that found that story captivating. It's not going to be real helpful in junior high ministry today if we're trying to figure out kind of what is the cutting edge of the problem. But to care enough to enter in, to tell the truth, to acknowledge that people are all the same really in the long run. I can't know all the stuff you and your friends are dealing with, but I can tell you what's true, and let me do that. And let me, not just kids, but all of us, engaged helping each other. That's where life is. That's what we're made for. And I think that is witnessed to in the story of this bride and groom wanting to help the daughters of Jerusalem, the young people in their world. I want to close with a prayer. It's probably the most well-known prayer in the world. It starts with the phrase, "Our Father." And the reason I want to close here is because I know there are people in this room and others that don't even know. Not only don't know how to ask for help, there's no one seeking them out. There's no community even that they know about. They don't know where to go to find help, to ask a question, to be taken seriously, to be listened to without rejection. They don't know if anybody would listen to them. And you know, so the question is, you know, if we're not a good enough community, what then even? And the language of the New Testament, what some of the most compelling insights of the New Testament are the freedom given to believers to call the heavenly King himself Father. Even beyond Father, Abba, Papa, Daddy. To address God himself in that language tells us that there is one. However bad our father was, our parents, our life, there is a heavenly Father who is interested in us. And we pray, speaking to him as Father, coming to him with our stuff, knowing that he listens, and he's the one that provides daily needs. He's the one that defends us from the evil one. He's the one that leads us when it's tempting. He is all those things for us. I'm going to pray, and if you want to join me, please do. If not, allow me to pray. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come. Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory forever.